may be that one of the reasons that
a lot of the rums, by the way, came after repeal. In order to get whiskey, you had to buy a case. You got a couple bottles of bourbon, but you had to buy a lot of rum. But there's some really neat stories about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd like to get
them. But you got to get them from the old, you know, the old guys.
It may be, I just throw this as a proposition, it may be that one reason that the distilled whiskey business has been somewhat in a decline has been that the industry has not done much with understanding American taste or...
Yeah, but that's not a backward look, that's a frontward look. See, and the provincial people that we've had are traditionally looking backwards, inward, day to day.
Well, how do you explain people going from blended whiskey to straight whiskey, or in the 60s going from straight whiskey
to... I wish I could show you. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You're not going to solve anything in a day. I was asked to talk about that very same thing, and how I was asked to do it was a friend of mine in Texas got drunk and was very involved in the sales and marketing organization in Dallas, and he bought a full-page ad in the Dallas newspaper. And then he woke up and realized what he'd done, didn't know what to do with it, so he offered it for us to use. He said, here, you use it. I don't have any need for it. And I get to do anything I want to. And that's what I talked about. And I'm going to send you a copy of it. I'm going to have it ready in about a week. It goes directly at that point, but it tries to go a little wider. It's the answer to the question that you asked.
You know, you said that whatever they learned from the past might not be applicable. You wouldn't pick it up and say, this is what they did in 1940 that worked, I'll do that this year. But you could say, the thing they did in 1940 was to look beyond what they were doing the last year. That's what we need to do now.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, in general, just a conceptual way, it could be useful to people in the industry to be able to have some idea of the past of the industry. In a lot of industries, maybe not so much in this one, but there is this musical chairs at the top where the people don't have any idea of the product's history or the company's history or any of the tradition that goes with it.
If you were to ask me what part of what you're doing has any relevance to helping us, the Kentucky Distillers, okay, then anything prior to about the Civil War would have a great deal. Anything after that would have very little. Okay, not necessarily the Civil War, but certainly after about 1905, 1910.
Because that was its boom year?
No, I'm talking about what role might history play that would be relevant in helping we, the Kentucky Distillers, interest media in pursuing some facet of the great American spirit, okay? Well, the interesting part of bourbon whiskey is its early role in the social development of the West, how it got here in the first place, those wonderful little accidents. And that's mainly the Elijah Craig, James Crow, even certainly through the first bottling in 1870 with George Garvin Brown. Then it starts to sound industry, it gets a little dull. But up until about how they got through the Civil War was absolutely incredible. If you take our little situation, for instance, and think, and we sit here and wring our hands about how hard doing business is. Now, how would you like to be running a distillery during the Civil War, trying to stay in business with troops going back and forth? Now, we know when there's insurrection, what's the first thing the population wants to do? And that's break in a whiskey store, right? Well, it was the same thing during the war, that all the troop movements through the state just happened to line up against distilleries. They go this way to get to a distillery to spend the night. Well, you got to wear a gray hat one night and a blue hat the next night. And all the time, John Hunt Morgan's blowing up the trains, the LNs trying to stay in business so they can bring barrels and the barrels in, grain in, get whiskey out. And then in our particular case, of course, and I'm sure every one of them had a little idiosyncrasies that even made it worse. my great-great-grandfather, who operated a distillery, was also a sheriff. Okay, he was high sheriff in Nelson County. And most of the thugs that were running around then, we were kin to them. Now, you know, I'm talking about the Frank and Jesse James and the Pences, Donnie and Bud Pence, who were members of Quantrill's Army and the original James Gang. These were family. So, and when they came from Missouri in '65, they came to Bardstown. We were hiding them out. So you think about having to keep a lot of balls up in the air just to keep the damn business running. Mm-hmm. And I've got some absolutely wonderful things where my great-great-grandfather would provide money to one cause over here and then would be a patron over here on this side. It was just ridiculous. And all the family members going this way and that into the war.
Yeah. But hasn't this policy of, you know, going to both sides really continued right up to the present? I mean, in terms of, for instance, politics, going back to the 40s and 50s, hasn't the industry largely been approached in Kentucky by politicians from both sides and basically given to both sides?
We've never had, now I'm not saying it would have been any different if DSI would have had more backbone. But clearly, if you were to look through and say, what's the politics of our industry? It is, we have demonstrated the inability over time to manage the courage of our convictions, time and time again. We're gutless. I mean, that's not pointing any fingers, because we're there, we've been there longer than the rest of them, so, you know, we're... But if I were to look back and say, what did DSI do wrong? Maybe wrong. It may have been worse if they'd have been a little hard-headed on a lot of these issues. It may have been a lot worse. You know, they would know I wasn't there. But I did get involved in the Kentucky distillers, even in '67, when you had Mr. Thompson and Jerry Bean and my daddy and Ed Deutsch. From Shanley, that's somebody you ought to talk to. He lives up on Ridge Road. He's a neighbor of ours. He was the first man to see me when I was born. He ran Louisville Cooperage since repeal. And he was Lou Rosensteel's right-hand man. He's a tough old son of a bitch. He was probably of all the people in those meetings, he's the only one that was asking questions. Well, why do we have to knuckle under? He's the only one. That's a must. That guy's an absolute must. Because what you'll do, you'll get, you know, the way I like to go at things, which is fairly straightforward, from a guy that was there. And very, very frustrated with the industry's inability to screw their... Yeah, he's about 80. But he's sharp as it be. Yeah, you got to see him. If you're interested in why have we allowed ourselves to be pushed and shoved around. Now, I'm not saying we ought to fight the consuming public. We ought to demand our right to be in business. No, no, they gave us a right to be in business. You know, the American public repealed Prohibition. We didn't do it. And there's certain rights that we're entitled to with that. Well, the industry was never sure of their legitimacy. They never felt comfortable with being legitimate.
Why do you feel that way?
There's a lot of forces that these old timers would know. I could speculate and I could come down on them, and that's not fair. Because I wasn't there.
Part of that is public perception too, and perhaps the industry has not really taken proper leadership. For instance,
look what Budweiser, just look right now, Budweiser's sponsorship of the Olympics, right? Mm-hmm. Immediate first reaction, bad taste, right? They handle it like a champ, because mm-hmm. they had some guts, right? Mm-hmm. That's all I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. We have those very same things come up for at least the 25 years that I've been kind of listening around and stuff. And we always go the safer route for today.
It's okay. It's okay in the public perception to advertise on TV beer. It's okay to advertise wine, but it's never apparently been okay to advertise liquor. It would seem to me that the hard liquor. It would seem to me that the industry now, after it's gone through this period of catharsis or purgation, you know, being the bad guys and the sins of the saloon keepers and so forth, it would seem now is the opportune time for the industry to move ahead. Yet one doesn't get that perception.
That's right. Spirits advertising could be done in very good taste. And it would be done in good taste for the right reasons. Not that to do them in good taste keeps the dogs off of us, but to do them in good taste is precisely the way to earn the right into the people's heads and hearts, which you have to do in order to sell them something, and in order to keep the privilege of staying in business, we as an industry. I guess if I were starting over, I wouldn't be in this industry for that reason, okay? I would have taken one look at this thing and seeing that let's don't fight, I'd rather fight than switch. So, it's an incompatible situation. But of course, here I get to do what I want to do. And we never, ever do the predictable other than not screw the whiskey up. And that's what makes it fun.
It's a successful formula.
Yeah. And we don't offend anybody. We don't offend anybody other than we offend some of the people, some of the members of the industry who get nervous with all the editorial we get. Okay, but that's not a plus or minus. We'd all be helped if everybody generated a lot more interest in bourbon whiskey.
You mentioned earlier the shift in the industry out of Kentucky, Jim Beam towards Chicago and the New York influence and so forth. How do you explain that?
December 1933 is when that happened. And that's Roosevelt. Nobody had it. He said, okay, let's make and sell whiskey tomorrow morning. And the distillers were saying, hey, we don't have any whiskey to sell, and two, we don't have any money to get back in business. These plants have been out of business 14 years. Nobody's got any money. And you can't age 6-year-old whiskey in 13 hours. So it was a natural. That's where the Hiram Walkers came from. That's where Seagram's came from. Shenley was a Cincinnati native, but one of those oddballs that nobody liked because he was a nonconformist. Rosenstiel. Rosenstiel was a mover and shaker.
For political reasons, it's easy to see why Roosevelt wouldn't have said, let's repeal and you can start selling in 4 years. With the job.
Oh, I think he did the right thing. I think he had his priorities lined up right. But still,
it made a hard situation.
It made it a very difficult situation for the Kentucky distillers to regroup in anything resembling the form of an industry located, headquartered here in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the KDA now. Who are the active people in it?
Well, Frank Daly's president. John Mormon's now the chairman. He succeeded me, and he's a good one.
And he's from Grand Forks.
Yeah. And you need to talk to Frank. We don't have much strength in KDA as far as policy, because it's basically an as the heads have moved out and on into other things, we have been left with, I don't look around, I don't see Jerry Beam anymore, I don't see that kind of person. I don't see the Thompsons anymore. You get the classic operating person with blinders on that takes information, runs home, maybe presents it, not good at presenting issues. When we had questions, Frank and I would normally run around the board, like we needed money for the New York promotion. We called for the operating officers of all the companies to get that done. So the KDA is mainly in place to deal with plant operations, with local legislative kinds of things.
When you say plant operations, what are
distillery
you elaborating?
Well, I'm talking about moving whiskey around and local tax problems, and we're not as active in the legislature as we used to, but Frank's fairly nimble when it comes to anticipating where the next blow may arise from.
How important do you believe the doubling of the production tax in 1955, 1956 is in the decline of the industry within the state? And have there been things that the state has not done to help the industry along? Or is it largely the federal problems that supersede the
state
problems?
Well, that's interesting. Let's take the state. Think 1934, think large corporations, some multinational, at least between Canada and U.S., okay? And think about companies that are interested in the political environment. How well is this state really interested in my business and my sort of business, okay? Well, what Happy Chandler sent that loud signal is we want to get rid of the distillers. Okay, now that's very difficult for somebody that's got all their operations here like a Jim Beam to do. It would have been very difficult for us. But it wasn't difficult at all for the big companies. They're saying, well, we don't need to be here. We got plants in Indiana. We got them out in California. We weren't looking at the large picture. And as a result, all of those that were multinational or at least much larger in shape in the state of Kentucky, moved their expanding operations. Okay, now this is a time when a lot of imports were starting to come in bulk. Now what we would have benefited from not having that production tax, which I don't see as a tax, I don't see it as a mechanical thing, I see it as an attitude, which caused companies who had options to make their investments elsewhere. Okay. What we were doing was bringing jobs into the country because the distillery jobs are mainly bottling jobs. Okay, and as a result of that tax, we got very few of the bottling jobs from imported bulk spirits that have developed very, very rapidly in the last 30 years. We got almost none of those except where we got lucky, namely Brown-Forman and Glenmore buying out old Mr. Boston. But for the most part, it's been going this way, or it's never come in. Now see, when Happy made his big decision, which was a result of the Kentucky distillers finally screwing up their courage, they came down on the wrong side of the fence. Okay. The one time they did it, and by God, they guessed wrong. They've never done it again.
This is interesting.
One time they did wrong, and he said, I'm going to get you sons of bitches. And that's the way he got us. It's just that simple. And you can ask him, and that's what he'll say. He said, I owed him one. But what he did was he really harmed the state of Kentucky, because that was a time when imported lots of the job expansion, most of the capital was already in place in Kentucky. We had a leg up to get those bottling jobs, which were just starting to develop, from bottling Canadian whiskey, Scotch whiskey, all sorts of blended whiskeys imported. We didn't get any of it. And then you've got the Brown-Formans and the Glenmores that were right next to the river, so they could very easily build aging facilities outside of Kentucky and still get the benefit of saying Kentucky whiskey. See, they make it, age it a year here, get it out of there. And then they were bringing it back for bottling. And then they said, this is stupid. Why don't I build a bottling plant over in Indiana? Which they did. So it's, that would have been a difficult argument to convince anybody, because you'd have to look into the future. It's an argument the industry tried to make, that the industry was changing, that this is not the way to get the industry. Mm-hmm. If you really want to get the industry, put it on consumption rather than production, because production equals economic well-being. But Schenley and National saw the signal. They said, oops, they don't want us. And boy, that was the end of the capital.
As I understand it, it was not until 1963 that the industry pushed to have Spindletop Research, an independent research organization, study this tax. And of course, within several months, the Spindletop group came out and said the tax must be repealed. And of course, going back earlier, Chandler's own revenue commissioner had said to repeal it, James Martin had said to repeal it. Duncan had said to repeal it. Do you believe that the industry simply avoided attacking this issue of the tax for so long because of fear of
sure.
the state government?
Absolutely. Frank Daley was involved in that. Frank came to work at KD right at the end of that. Who was Nana Lampton's first husband? It was
Cox.
Yeah, Cox. Millard Cox was the lawyer for the KDA during those early periods. And he's the one that really, everybody blames him for getting us in that box, you know, which is the first time we ever came down on the political issue, century appeal. Frank knows the specifics of those kind of things. Certainly my father does.
Where do we find Frank? Where's
at the McClure building. That's the Kentucky Distillers Office, Frankfort, Kentucky.
Okay, that's why we're not finding it. We keep looking in phone books and things, and it's not here. It's a Frankfort.
That's a Frankfort.
Okay, good.
But yeah, he knows that end of it because he was there.
Yeah.
That's his stuff.
Are there some more people whose names come to mind? I'm grateful for the ones who have come up with this.
Of course, you got a lot of them down Brown Foreman, Shipman, and.
Shipman, but we
did.
Yeah, we have one interview that somebody else didn't.
I didn't know that.
It's been with that in the last 6 months.
Oh, gosh darn. He's a neat guy.
Well, the interview is good. It's all, the interview is almost all on prohibition. That was the focus of the project. But it's a good interview.
George Graves did it for the Global Times.
Are there some more? I know the. You might have suggestions at Brown Foreman that they won't make. We'll be getting input from them, and we've gotten a little bit already. But are there some people there who aren't obvious that you think of as good candidates?
Ben Morris, who's retired, has probably spent more of his life on the history of the company and to some extent the history of the industry than anybody down there.
How about in the regulating process? Are there some people
some old timers
who've been around longer?
Frank would be a good one to ask that. There's a couple of old timers that were with ATF in the beginning. They would be good. Dad would know that, you know, would be much more aware of those kinds of things.
Okay.
There's almost nobody alive today that started in Prohibition, you know, right at the end of Prohibition in with the job of building and running a distillery. So that's where Dad would probably be interesting because he may be the he and the Colonel may be the only ones alive that did it. They actually were involved in rebuilding, starting up, and then the state after.
We're going to try to schedule your father pretty soon.
Yeah, you better do that before November.
And do you have a phone number for him that we can?
Yeah, 3-4. Yeah, we never use it. We've got a direct line down there, 583-9062. That's a Louisville, 583-3962. Now we have a 9062, yeah.
9062.
583-9062 is
right.
Okay. Lucy Beam's up here. Jerry is with her. And of course, she's interesting for a whole lot of reasons. She's just an interesting human.
Jeremiah
Beam or Lucy Beam. She's Dr. Kavanaugh's daughter from Lawrenceburg. Remember the old lady that had the wonderful school, the military school in Lawrenceburg? The famous old Kavanaugh Academy. Well, she descends from those two. Oh, they've written 100 million things about that. And she's a character. She is something special.
Good talker?
The best.
Good.
She's the best that you'll talk to.
Okay. Good. One thing that struck me going through the newspaper files on this is that the industry has not really focused on how important its contribution to taxes has been to state and local government. We talked about this in the very beginning.
Well, we haven't. No, that's not exactly right. It's who gives a damn? See, you can feed the dog dog food, but if the dog doesn't want to eat the dog food, you just can't keep piling it up on it. And that's what we've had. Nobody cares. Nobody that matters cares.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Do you think that's still true today?
Well, I think it's even more so. Because one of the arguments not nearly as valid as it used to be.
Every year. A smaller percentage.
You make less of it. And of course, the tax hasn't increased as a function of inflation. But no, I don't think that dog has many opportunities to be on. I don't think so.
You said you'd go into something else. What would you go into if you were to start out today?
It would have to be pretty interesting, pretty provocative. I'd have to be in charge. You know, that's the reason, because I get to do what I want to do.
How long has that been true, that you've been able to do what you want to be?
Oh, it's probably a couple, 3 years. But, you know, it's an evolution, too. You kind of learn, you learn to capture what's important in the marketing, and then we go do it. And fortunately, the way we've decided to do it's reasonably non-traditional. So that's what keeps it interesting.
Is the company going great guns
these days? Yeah. Well, we're not great guns because we're so small, but we're moving forward as fast as we can go, as fast as we want to go.
Mm-hmm. The beyond the candies, are you doing something else that is newer or?
No, just the communications. Okay. That's kind of
but not
involved.
New product.
No, that's about all we can handle.
Okay. How many people are employed by?
We've got 50.
You've got a terrific market image for a company.
Yeah, that nobody's heard of, right? We're just a little bitty guy.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, that's okay.
The jobs we provide are not direct jobs. They're service jobs. I am never down there that we don't have engineers on the grounds, that we don't have somebody bringing the grain in, painting. I would say without question that the contribution that the company makes is like 15 to 20 times a year beyond payroll. It's just the nature of the beast. It's just not a labor-intense industry.
Has that always been true?
Oh, Lord, no. That's what you're going to find out when you go back and look at the storekeeper gaugers, because for every storekeeper gauger, you need 3 babysitters. You got locks, you got the little simple things. You had to, when you put whiskey in the barrel to put them away, you had to weigh the damn barrels empty. Then you had to put the whiskey in, then you had to weigh the barrels full. Just think about that one.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, it's like 30 times faster now.
So the regulation process itself was the generator of lots of jobs.
Yes, absolutely.
Not just the production. But the
most of them. And then, of course, the other area was in the bottling, where everything was done by hand.
Other than for the late 1940s, as I understand it, this industry has not had much problem with labor. Is that a fair assessment?
Now, I'm not good at that. We haven't.
Because Kentucky has a bad national image for labor. You know, go to New York. You know,
yeah, it does.
They owe, really does. Well, business people always focus on, you know, asking questions on them. But this industry seems to have got beyond that problem. Do you have any reflections?
I don't know, but I bet you Brown Foreman would. Our situation is we're non-union, and we don't have any turnover. And we are in a part of Kentucky where we are dealing with very traditional, loyal people. And if you've got the God-given sense to understand that these wonderful people will do anything as long as you don't surprise them and cheat them. It's just very simple formula. You don't spring a change. You get them ready for change. Very, very loyal. Very unbelievably dependent, and really just a lot of fun because they can, you know, they can put up with inept management. So there, that's.
We're going to have to go down and take a tour of the
Yeah, you ought to sit, you ought to talk to the people. That's really where you get a much better feel of the business, kind of snooping around.
Would yours be a good one for us to focus on otherwise as an example?
Well, I don't know.
Very different from Brown-Forman in a lot of ways?
Well, in a sense, it isn't different at all because we all kind of started the same place. You know, we started about 100 years earlier, but and they were a lot better at what they did from management of asset standpoint.
I'm thinking that the labor situation would be fairly different. The size and scope of the company would be somewhat different. I don't know.
I don't know. There's not many options.
Are there a lot of people at your place who've been there a long time?
Oh, sure.
On your production side?
Oh, yeah. I'm one of the newcomers, and I've been there 17 years. Well, you've really only got a couple of alternatives that are meaningful, my sense is. And that's Jim Beam and Heaven Hill and Us.
Oh, too bad, because that's all been good stuff. It certainly has gone in our heads, but we're trying to
well, there's a lot
cover
of ways
some
to tighten
of the
that up, though.
Later.
Yeah. Well, we'd like to come back, you know, as we get the idea of you know, your perspective on it, and you know, we can hone in on that.
Well, mine's just
more,
little pieces right? growing up or, you know, around not paying a whole lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
Very specifically, I'd made my mind up. I would, because we didn't have a business to come back to. So I was set on becoming an aerospace engineer. It was in the late 50s when that was a rather fashionable thing to do. So even as a youngster, I didn't pay a lot of attention to what was going on over there. I spent one summer working at the distillery and spent the rest of my summers working on the highway as a laborer. And then when I was in law school, well, in engineering school, in the aerospace industry, always working summers there. And in law school in the patent office. So it was really not until 67 that I even started thinking about it.
So did you get started, did you practice aerospace engineering for a while? Did you want
to yeah,
do that?
Yeah.
Where'd you do that?
At Aerojet General Corporation, Sacramento.
Did you like that?
Oh, not too much. Yeah, I liked the think and do part of it. I didn't like being in California. It's just a little impersonal, a little big, a little, you know, it's a little hard coming out of Bardstown.
So you came back and
well, I went to law school then. Yeah, I went to law school after I went to Vanderbilt. And then when I got through that, began working in 1967.
So when did you graduate from college?
62, and then went to graduate school.
So there wasn't a long,
year,
real
then,
long lapse between you.
And then, yeah, did a just like you, Cheryl, overeducated.
Tell me that. Well, it's a good way to switch gears, though, to get another degree. And not switch gears.
I wouldn't have done it that way if I'd started over. Because there's absolutely no correlation between being successful in business and being overeducated.
It's just
wasted
business,
time.
It's anything else.
Yeah.
It probably has done you some good to have a little bit of law background to deal with the lawyers you'd have to deal with.
No.
Not at all?
No. No, I beat up
where'd
on
you go?
Whoever
you go
it is
to,
anyway.
Oh, you
I just instincts. I don't have to know what I'm doing. I come out swinging anyway, so that doesn't make any sense. I do the same thing in advertising. I do our advertising. It was only last week I read my first book on advertising. You know, so knowledge ain't got anything to do with it. It's just got
instincts.
It.
Yeah. Is that kind of the way your dad operates? Too?
No, Lord,
very
no.
Different
no, no. Very much a craftsman. Very deliberate, very slow, very traditional, extremely bright, patient, understanding, do one thing, do it better than anybody. And I let more fall through the cracks than he, you know, normally does. But I do a lot more things wrong.
But you must compensate with it for being a good
well, what
strategy.
I do, I've got an interesting perspective on all this. I pretend in all my decisions that he's looking over my shoulder, even though he's not. And it really reins in that aggressiveness and impatience. Because after all, if the responsibility we have to the marketplace is to do it better and to not disappoint. And my instincts, the first instincts, are let's do something different. that's not the business we're in. So I have to have a sort of a predictable mechanical way to get that reined in. So every time I want to go out in left field, I say, well, what if you were just sitting around here? That's
we're in a period now of a major national discussion as to the necessities or non-necessities for regulation of various industries. The liquor industry in Kentucky in 1940 has come under the state fair trade law. Could you discuss your ideas about the fair trade legislation, the matter, and those of your father, as to their beneficial effect and their non-beneficial effect? And what problems have you found with the fair trade legislation?
Well, the main problem I have is not looking at it from the perspective of necessarily what's in the best interest of the company, although I think it is. It's more of a personal bias. I have a very strong personal bias against legislation or regulation which appears and generates the illusion that it is in the interest of the consuming public, and in fact is there to protect inefficiencies, laziness, and all in and among industry members. And that is precisely what any kind of fair trade legislation does. That's precisely what Buy America does. If we can't compete, we shouldn't be around. The government does not owe me a living, it doesn't owe a retailer a living. So that's where I come from. We had a very interesting illustration of this very same thing about a month ago. We called Senator Ford. We want to ship our candy, bourbon candy, to Neiman Marcus because they want to buy it. Now that's great. That's just exactly the way it ought to be. A Kentucky product that the Neiman Marcus people are just shaking their fist to get hold of. And we found we can't ship it out of Kentucky. So there's a little gal in Senator Ford's office that went looking at the reason why, and there's an FAA regulation law that was enacted which was specifically targeted at this sort of thing. Yet as long as it has alcohol, it can't be shipped in interstate commerce. Well, the farther they looked, they found out it didn't have anything to do with what it was purported. It was a law that was pushed through Congress by the confectionery association to protect itself against imports from Sweden and Switzerland and others. So this doesn't have any, they're not looking out for the American public. We're not, in all honesty, looking out for the American public when we say fair trade is in their best interest. Because I can promise you one thing, the industry makes more money in a fair trade environment. And how that is in the best interest of the consuming public. Well, if you know Ford well enough, when somebody says can't do that, usually gets him fired. Yeah, it'll get done. It'll get done because of him. Because it doesn't make any sense. And he was just mad as hell when he found out why.
I remember that coming up back in the 70s when Mitch worked for Somebody else wanted to do the same thing. I remember they were doing it.
Well, it's Boone and Popper. John Boone's he was very helpful. He said, I've thrown up my hands. I can't deal with it. And I said, yeah, we need him. Because it needs to be everybody. It needs to be everybody that's got a Kentucky product, a legitimate Kentucky product. And see, the thing about it, they started off saying, well, it'll make you drunk. Well, Christ, you die of sugar diabetes long before you'd ever notice any alcohol. And they started going farther and farther, and they found that it was a big sham. Fair trade's a big sham on the public. Now, I make more money under fair trade, but that's not the government's responsibility to help me make more money.
As I understand it, even with the fair trade legislation, there was no industry-wide push in Kentucky for a rise in floor price fair trade legislation until the late 50s or early 60s, which is a fairly long period of time.
One of the first meetings that I went to on that issue was immediately after I got to school in 1967.
part, as I understand it, the 4% increase could be handled in the ABC board. Okay, we went to a hearing, and Heaven Hill, I think, was the initiator of the thing, because they were, and everybody was scared to death. Why? Because we didn't want to cook the goose that laid the golden egg. And believe it or not, even free market principles were beginning to infiltrate our industry. A little bit, not much, but a little bit.
I've got a state. I
don't really think it's a state. We have other states. It's set it up in the middle.
Do one thing, and you being outside.
I'm a New Yorker. I'm a total outsider.
We got that during John Brown's administration, because he's a very objective guy, and he brought in a lot of large picture, objective kind of humans around him. And he's the one that repealed the state half of the ad valorem tax. First governor since Isaac Shelby to sign a liquor bill. Isn't that incredible?
Mm-hmm.
Blame it on the Baptists, blame it on this. I don't know, I don't know where the, well, my sense is that it's one of those evolutionary things that you can't ever get to the tail of the dog. It's just hard to, I'll tell you something else you'll never come to. You'll never demonstrate when Kentucky whiskey became bourbon whiskey. Because it just wasn't something that happened one day.
It's slippery, isn't it?
It is extremely slippery.
Believe me, many, many things in history are. I mean, you celebrate centennials and things. And
that's a good example.
And you can pick a date, you can pick the state when they formed the first organization to explore the issue. You can pick the one where the hospital opened, had the first patient. You can pick any number of dates. And basically, you pick it about what year you want to celebrate within bounds. You have to have something to fit it to. Most history is not nearly as easy to say, now it wasn't, now it was. It just doesn't work that way. But you know, for you to have that kind of perspective, that moves you way beyond the distilled spirits industry. For you to have that perspective that things are not black and white, that things evolve, and that's a big
thing. It's a lot more fun when they do evolve. And what I've enjoyed more than any single thing was, I wonder why this happened, and what are these people doing here? Not that they're here, but what the hell they come here for? And then start rooting around, and oh, well, that makes sense. And it always makes sense when you get to the right answer. But getting there is sometimes not direct because nobody ever really was worried about that sort of thing. You know, the old corn writs and all. The thing, well, we started back in 1793, 94, when George Washington and Colonel Nelson drove everybody out of Carlisle with the Whiskey Rebellion. Well, Christ, we had about 1,800 distillers here before then, and back 14 years before that.
Mm-hmm. Things get started and they have.
They just kind of.
People keep repeating them.
They keep repeating them, and then they gain authority. Yeah. Isn't that something?
It's crazy.
It surely is.
Well, it makes it fun to go back into something, though, that you've got a pat answer for and find out.
I think one of the things I would really love to know is the role the industry played in bringing the thoroughbred industry into Kentucky. It's fairly significant.
I don't know about that at all. What do you think about that?
Well, again, I'm just going back to what we did. It's a series of things. Patrick Henry, as governor of Virginia, wanted to keep the Indians off his ass. Okay? And early in 1780, we were renamed the Kentucky County. Virginia. It was just a frontier before that. Okay, so, and the first form of Western settlement to encourage permanent settlement in the history of the country was the Corn Writs, 1780. Permanent settlement was needed. Why? To get humans down here to deal with the Indians. No strategic plans how the people were going to defend themselves or how they were going to deal with the Indians. Just kind of put them together and see what happens. And so the land grant thing. That first grant was set up to get them down here and then see how innovative they could be. Well, and what they decided to use was Indian maize. And they used maize, not that that was magical, but that took all summer to grow. And they had to plant it and harvest it and stay there. And that was the deal. They had to raise the native grain for three successive seasons, and they got their 60 acres free. Well, he didn't give a damn about it. You know, what are they going to do with the corn? Well, that's the next question. Well, of course, our people knew what to do with the corn. All right, so we got whiskey. Now, what do we do with the whiskey? There's no market. You know, this business about how much easier it is to haul a gallon of whiskey back over the mountains than it is five bushels of grain. They didn't haul anything back over the mountains. That was insane. The first markets were in New Orleans. Put this stuff in on flatbeds right at the bottom of the falls of the Ohio Downs, she went. Now the next question, okay, we got to New Orleans, how do we get home? See, that's the way I kind of followed the thing through. Well, they were bringing these Spanish show horses back. And guess what? That's where the Natchez Trace got its name from. The Natchez Trace was founded, was formed, was developed solely to bring people hauling whiskey from Kentucky, from New Orleans, back into central Kentucky. You know, so we were directly responsible for the Natchez Trace, and I guess indirectly responsible for thoroughbred industry, because, and then you get a bunch of horses back here, then what do you got? Then you find out if the horses do well in Kentucky with this limestone soil or not. Well, they did. Now, let's bring more horses. So that's the way kind of things happen. That's not bang, 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 but that's, there's a very close kinship between our industry, but it wasn't an industry. It was a bunch of guys trying to survive. They used whiskey for money. First money of the West was Kentucky whiskey. But it sure wasn't bourbon. It just happened to be made from corn. And the other thing, why is rye used today with bourbon? Very logical. Very logical. Where did these people come from that reacted to the corn rinse? They came from Pennsylvania. What kind of guys were they? They were Scots and Scotch-Irish. What did they do? They made whiskey. What did they make it from? They make it from the native grain of Pennsylvania. It was rye. What about their personality? It was very predictable. Very conservative people. The Scots always have been. So they say, if I got to go down here and raise this grain, I know what I'm going to do with it. I don't know how it's going to do. I'm going to take some of what I know about with me. And in between the corn rows, they planted rye. So, and that's why bourbon formulation is traditionally corn and rye. So those kinds of things. Somebody needs to deal with that a hell of a lot more thoughtfully and thoroughly than I have. But I've done all I could really suffer through, because I don't deal well sitting still and that kind of stuff. But I did. I put in about a year and a half, and all I did was just bring my people down and ask all those questions. Why'd they do this? Where'd they come from? Why'd they do this that way? I wonder why this worked out this way.
What'd you do? Read a lot of books? Go to a library?
Well, no, I hired a guy and almost put me in bankruptcy and got him to do an incredibly thorough job on Carlisle, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, because that's where they all came from. And I'm talking about the Rowlands and Federal Hill and all those old guys. It just, those early tax lists read like the early tax lists around Bardstown. And Mad Anthony Wayne was one of them. It's just amazing the people that evolved out of the war that, well, before the war, there they were. They were neighbors of ours up in Carlisle.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
And of course, that's where the Whiskey Rebellion was.
What became of that document? Do you have that document that you put
in? Oh, I've got to put it in the documents. It's just file drawers full of stuff. But I wasn't looking for any. I got kind of curious about it because I knew the history of the industry wasn't right. I knew everybody was trying to make it black and white, and then they were trying to move black over to where it could help them sell whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
So you take those two objectives, and you're not ever going to get anywhere near the right answer.
Right.
And I just did it for me. We've never used it. It's just kind of a fun thing. It's a fun thing to understand.
It'd be nice to make available to somebody else sometime.
It's really disorganized. It isn't any magic. Lots of it.
But it sounds like a good research question.
Tell you that.
On that subject.
Yeah, it's probably
origins
the only one
origins
that is.
The whiskey industry in Carlisle, Kentucky.
But if you, as long as we all understand, it wasn't an industry then.
Yeah.
It was an adjunct to an agricultural existence.
True.
And that's all.
I might be on your trail to see if you want to share that with us.
Yeah. You can have anything you want on that, but it's going to drive you crazy.
Well, no, see, I don't have to read it. I just have to make it ready for those people 50 years from now who want to read it. That we probably better not take too much of your time.
Can I ask one more question? John Ed Pierce, in the book that he did in 1969, 1970, for the 100th anniversary of Brown-Forman, says that the corn that's used, at least by Brown-Forman, is non-Kentucky corn. He says it comes from Illinois, Indiana, Western Ohio. The rye is Canadian rye. And the water is purified water.
It may be here, yeah. That's
with